So we move on to theories of meaning. We've had a look at the context principle and the principle of compositionality. Remember that the context principle says that a word has meaning only in the context of a sentence, and the principle of compositionality says that apart from a finite number of exceptions, the meaning of a complex linguistic expression is a function of the meanings of its semantically significant parts and of the way they're combined. Those are two principles that we mentioned in the previous two lectures and talked quite a bit about. And I also mentioned the principle of creativity, which is that we can use and understand language creatively. That's to say, we can understand and produce new sentences on the basis of having learnt the meanings of the component words and the grammar of the language. We don't have to have been specifically drilled in the meaning of those new sentences. And I suggested that the principle of compositionality is adduced to model that creativity of language. We can think of the speaker as computing the meanings of new sentences on the basis of the meanings of the parts and the way they're put together. And this means that we can model a finite being's mastery of an infinitistic system like a language, which in principle can generate endless new sentences. Now, one of the main aims of modern philosophy of language is to give a systematic account of meaning. And for Frege, by contrast with the empiricist tradition, and in particular by contrast with Locke, meaning is a public phenomenon. So the meanings of words and sentences, as it were, lie on their surface and are available to everyone. When we communicate in a language, we have access to the same meanings. The same meanings get transferred from speaker to hearer. And the contrast with the Lockean tradition is this, that Locke essentially thought of the meaning of a word as a private idea, something that is available only to an individual speaker. So a little mental picture, in other words, which I associate with a word, that would be my understanding of it. You would associate your mental picture with the word as its meaning. And those mental pictures were essentially confined to the minds of the people who are entertaining them and are private to those minds. So can't be communicated. And this meant that Locke, although this wasn't his intention, made a bit of a mystery of communication. If private ideas are essential to understanding, as he thought, so understanding a word is a matter of entertaining a private idea, and if private ideas are essentially individual, they cannot be communicated, then it becomes a mystery how meaning is communicated at all, how we're able to communicate using language. And Frege essentially swept away that whole tradition. He got rid of the problem by, in effect, saying that ideas have got nothing to do with meaning. By that he meant ideas in Locke's sense. Ideas in any sense in which they are individualistic entities, in which my ideas are not the same as your ideas, those are irrelevant to meaning, or at least irrelevant to the main aspects of meaning that occur in communication. Frege did allow that there were various aspects of meaning, but the two main aspects which we'll be looking at in more detail in due course were, for Frege, sense and reference, and these were both publicly available, objective aspects of meaning. Nothing private or individualistic about them. So Frege was in effect inverting the Lockean tradition. Locke starts off with the individual and the individual's understanding of a word or a sentence. Then he moves on, as it were, to another individual and diagnoses that other individual's understanding of a word and a sentence. And then, only then, does he ask, well, how do these two individuals communicate? How does meaning cross the gap between them? But by the time he raises that question, he's, as it were, made an answer impossible, because he's in effect identified meaning with an incommunicable entity, namely a private idea, so that it becomes utterly mysterious how two individuals can possibly communicate. And Frege inverts that in the spirit, if you like, of a sort of wider context principle by saying, well, no, we should think of language first and foremost as an instrument of communication. It's not an individualistic phenomenon, it's a group or a social phenomenon. So communication is, as it were, the baseline, the starting point. Language is what happens, what we use in communication. So the basic fact is that meanings are shared, are publicly available items. We have to start from there and take that as read, and not start from another point and then find that it's a mystery how on earth meanings can be communicated, as Locke did. We start from the basic datum that meanings are whatever does get communicated in communication. So meanings are essentially internal accusatives, to use a grammatical term, of acts of communication. That's to say they get their nature, they get their essence and point from the act of communication. They're internal to it. So we start off with an objectivist conception of meaning and a public conception. Meaning is an objective public phenomenon available to everyone who speaks the language. And then the question is, to what extent can we give an account of that kind of linguistic meaning, and to what extent can that account be systematic? And the idea of a systematic theory of meaning, which was inspired by Frege's work originally, is that it ought to be possible to construct a theory which derives meanings of sentences from the meanings of their component parts and the way they're put together. So, in other words, draws on the principle of compositionality to produce a systematic account of how sentences acquire their meanings. And then the idea is that if we can attribute such a theory to speakers, if we can say that in some sense they have internalized this theory, or that it models their linguistic understanding, then the thought is we would have some kind of explanation, at least in the sense of a modelling, of their linguistic ability. And I've been using the word compute several times to suggest that you can think of speakers as computing the meanings of new sentences on the basis of their knowledge of the meanings of old sentences, because in effect what they do is they decompose the old sentences into their component parts, and new sentences are then just reconfigurations of the old parts in some way that is grammatically allowed for in the language. So we think of the speaker as having internalized a lexicon, a dictionary, so knowing the meanings of at least a reasonable number of words in the language, knowing the grammar, and then putting these two things together to generate sentences, new sentences, so to be able to produce new sentences and also to be able to understand new sentences when they're encountered. And the idea of a systematic theory, as I say, is the idea of a theory that models that ability by making explicit that computational process in the form of deductions, in the form of a basic set of axioms, which will be the meanings of the individual words, so the lexicon entries, in effect, together with the grammatical rules of the language. So those are its basic components. And it then uses those components to generate in a deductively sound way all possible sentences in the language, so that a speaker's understanding of a new sentence can then be displayed as a deduction from the meanings of the component parts and the way they're put together. The speaker is thought of as knowing those component parts, the meanings of those component parts, knowing about the way they're put together, knowing the grammar, and then computing, as I say, or deducing from those input axioms and structures the meaning of any given sentence in the language, any given well-formed sentence in the language. And as I mentioned before, the general thought here is to model creativity. That's to say, to have some kind of explanation of speakers' ability on the basis of a finite training and a finite lexicon and grammar and finite brains, finite resources, in other words. So the speaker is equipped with finite resources and yet can understand new sentences and, in principle, an unlimited number of new sentences. So a systematic theory of meaning will give the meanings for sentences of a language, and it will do so, as we've said, by breaking those sentences down into their component parts and deriving the meanings of the whole sentence from the meanings of those component parts and the way they're put together in accordance with the principle of compositionality. So a systematic theory of meaning will differ from what is sometimes called a mere translation manual. And the idea of a translation manual, as that phrase is being used here, is a list which simply tells you what a whole sentence means, without breaking it down into its component parts, without deriving that meaning from those component parts. So something like a Berlitz guide, if you like, which simply tells you how to say in Czech or in Polish, where's the nearest 24-hour chemist, and it simply gives you an equivalent Polish sentence for that English sentence, but it doesn't try to teach you the language. It doesn't break the sentence down into its component parts. It simply gives you whole sentence equivalences for input sentences. Now, that kind of guide has its uses in certain contexts, but the point about a systematic theory of meaning is that it is attempting to model a speaker's understanding of language. And as we've said, that understanding is essentially creative. The speaker can produce and understand new sentences. And the translation manual doesn't give you any way of explaining or modelling that. If speakers understand sentences as wholes without breaking them down, then it's a mystery how they can understand new sentences. The speaker would have to learn each new sentence from scratch when it is encountered. One wouldn't be able to work out in advance or know in advance what the new sentence means. But, as we've said, speakers do have the ability to understand new sentences. And the idea behind a systematic theory of meaning is that it models that by showing how speakers operate with the principle of compositionality, how they understand sentences on the basis of understanding their component parts, and that then enables them to understand and produce new sentences, given that new sentences are formed out of old parts and the usual grammar. So that's the difference between a systematic theory of meaning and a translation manual. And we'll come back to that in a bit. But first, let's say a little bit about what a systematic theory of meaning actually looks like, what the mechanics of it are. And we need a bit of terminology here that you will encounter when you look at some of the literature on this subject. we call the language for which the theory of meaning is being given the object language. And the theory, of course, will itself be given in a language, and that is called the meta-language. And the idea is that the theory takes input sentences from the object language, so those sentences are, as it were, fed into it. It then applies its machinery to the input sentences. It breaks the sentence down into component words. It has a lexicon built into it so that it then can read off the meanings of the component words from its lexicon and then compute the meaning of the whole sentence on the basis of the grammar of the language, which it's also got wired into it. So it churns out an output sentence in the meta-language, in the language of the theory itself, which gives the meaning of the input sentence. And another piece of terminology that we need is the distinction between a homophonic and a heterophonic theory of meaning. A homophonic theory of meaning is one where the meta-language and the object language are the same. So you might give a theory of meaning for English in English, and that would be a homophonic theory of meaning. Alternatively, they might be different. You might give a theory of meaning for German in English, and that would be a heterophonic theory of meaning. So that's just a piece of terminology that we need. And as far as the demands of a systematic theory of meaning go, we're starting to get into more controversial territory now. But I would say that, and not everyone would agree with this, but I would say that as far as those demands go, it doesn't really make any difference whether your theory is heterophonic or homophonic. The theoretical aspects of the project are the same. The theories, of course, look different, but nothing of substance is really affected by whether you give the theory or whether you conceive of the theory as being given in the same language as the object language or in a different language. Now, let me explain this point a bit because, as I say, it is controversial. If you look on page 2, I think, of the lecture notes that I've put up on Canvas, there are some sample sentences, and I need to refer you to the written text here because the use of inverted commas, which is rather difficult to convey orally, is going to be very important. So if you look there at sentence 2, which reads, "Snow is white in inverted commas," so that sentence is in inverted commas, means that snow is white. And that is given as an example of the kind of thing that a homophonic theory of meaning for English might deliver. The sentence, "snow is white," would be one of the input sentences fed into the machinery of the theory. And then it would grind through its deduction. It would break that sentence down. It would then give meanings for the semantically significant parts of the sentence. And then it would compute the meaning of the whole sentence on the basis of those meanings of the individual words plus the grammar. And then it would churn out a clause, what we call a theorem of the theory, that would look like 2, in which the input sentence would appear on the left-hand side in inverted commas, in quotation marks, and then its meaning would be given in a that clause without quotation marks. So the sentence, and here we need another piece of terminology, which you may have come across, the distinction between mention and use, which is very important in philosophy. The sentence "snow is white" is mentioned on the left-hand side of this clause. And then we see that it occurs again on the right-hand side, but not in inverted commas this time. There it is used rather than mentioned. In other words, it's not referred to, it's not talked about, but it's used. Okay, so On the left-hand side, we have a name of that sentence, because putting inverted commas round a word is a way of naming that word or phrase, as we have here. So the sentence "Snow is white" with inverted commas written round it is a name of that sentence. And then the rest of the clause tells us what that sentence, which the phrase with the inverted commas round it names, the rest of the clause tells us what that sentence means. And in the homophonic case, it will simply say "means that," and then it'll use the same sentence again on the right-hand side, because we're giving the theory of meaning for English in English. Now, it may help to get a handle on what's going on here if we move to the heterophonic case and consider a theory of meaning for one language in another language. So look at example 3 in the lecture notes. And there you have the German sentence "Schnee ist weiß" on the left-hand side of the output clause, again in inverted commas because that sentence is being named. And the clause tells us that it means that snow is white. So the clause is a clause in a theory of meaning that's been given in English for German. So the meta language is English, the object language is German. And the theory will work in exactly the same way, in other words, as we've discussed, in other words, it'll take that input sentence and subject it to its machinery. It'll break it down into its component parts, give the meanings of those component parts, and then on the basis of German grammar, it will compute the meaning of the whole sentence and spit out that meaning in English, because it's a theory that's being given in English. Now, if you look at 3, which is the clause, the output clause for a theory of meaning for German given in English, you can see, I think, that substantial information is being conveyed by that clause. Somebody who doesn't know German can come to know what that sentence means if that person already knows English. So if you know the meta language, you can learn the object language, as it were, from reading these clauses in the theory of meaning. That's not to say that that's the point of the theory. It isn't. The point of a theory, a systematic theory of meaning, is not to teach anyone a particular language. We're not in the business of language instruction. We're in the business of modelling, of theorising about meaning. So we're in the business of saying what it is that a speaker who knows a language knows. What can we say of a general and systematic nature about that knowledge? And so clause 3, which is a fragment of a theory of meaning for German and English, tells us a little bit of that. It tells us what a German speaker knows in knowing the meaning of that sentence, "Schnee ist weiß." And it tells us that in English. But the reason why I said a while back that I don't really think the distinction between homophonic and heterophonic theories of meaning is a very deep or important one, is that the fact that the object language is, in the case of 3, is German and the meta language is English, doesn't mean that that theory differs in any fundamental way from a homophonic theory where the object language and the meta language are the same. It might look as though the heterophonic case was more informative, right? So if you don't know German already and you read clause 3, then that, as long as you know English, that tells you something you didn't know, right? But you might say, well, if I read clause 2 and I already know English, "snow is white," in inverted commas, means that snow is white, that doesn't tell me anything I didn't know. I can't learn anything from that. Either you know English already, in which case it doesn't tell you anything, or if you don't know English, it's not going to tell you anything either because you won't understand it. So 2 has got a sort of useless air about it, a sort of trivial air, whereas 3, the case where we're giving the meaning of a German sentence in English, that looks pretty substantial. I mean, that looks as though it's conveying information that is genuine information. It's information that somebody who doesn't know German doesn't have. and that you have to learn if you want to learn German. Okay, so it looks as though that kind of way of doing a theory of meaning, namely the heterophonic way, is more interesting and substantial than the homophonic way, as in case of clause 2, which looks trivial. And the point I want to make, and this is where there is some controversy, because you will find that some philosophers do say what I've just said, but another view, which is the one I agree with myself, is that that is a mistake, that there's nothing trivial, actually, about either the homophonic or the heterophonic case. They both convey substantial information, and that's why it doesn't matter whether when you're thinking about theories of meaning, it doesn't really matter whether you're thinking about the homophonic or the heterophonic case. Because although clause 2 might look trivial, might look useless, it isn't. That's a misleading impression. The sentence, snow is white, appears in inverted commas, is named on the left-hand side of the clause, and on the right-hand side, it is used. It doesn't appear in inverted commas, and that's a crucial distinction. So, in effect, what you're doing is you're specifying the meaning of an English sentence. You're doing so in English, which is what gives it the appearance of triviality, but you're nevertheless still conveying substantial information. You're conveying information that somebody who doesn't know English doesn't know and has to learn if that person wants to learn English. So it's substantial information that can be learnt and can be forgotten. So both 2 and 3 record learnable and forgettable facts. 2 records that kind of fact about an English sentence, and 3 records it about a German sentence. And these are contingent facts. The sentence, snow is white, in English, could have meant something else. Now, as I say, this is... don't believe what I'm telling you. Plenty of people will tell you that that's not right, that the sentence is individuated by its role in the language and its meaning, so that there's a sense in which the sentence snow is white couldn't have meant anything else. It would have been a different sentence if there'd been a different meaning. But my position is really that at some level of abstraction, at some level of thought, of thinking about these matters, there is a sense in which that sentence, that row of signs, if you like, could have had a different meaning. The collocation of letters or phonemes that is the English word snow, that makes up the English word snow, there's some sense in which that could have meant something else. This is a doctrine that often goes under the name of the arbitrariness of the sign. The modal properties of something depend on how it is individuated. So whether something is a necessary or contingent property of something depends on how it is individuated. And sometimes you can ring the changes on that. You can individuate an entity in such a way that a property is necessary. If you individuated that thing in a different way, that property would look contingent. So you can certainly individuate the English sentence snow is white in a narrow way, in such a way that its meaning is actually essential to it, and it therefore couldn't have had another meaning, not that very sentence. But it seems to me that if you abstract far enough, you can get to a level of individuation of those particular signs at which it is right to say that they could have meant something different, those very signs. They wouldn't have lost their identity if they'd meant something different. And it's that level of contingency that the theory of meaning is operating at. It's taking as input a bunch of signs, and it's telling you what they mean in a particular language. And those very signs could belong to more than one language. I doubt whether snow is white, that particular sentence, does belong to more than one language. But, you know, there are plenty of signs that of a shorter nature that belong to more than one language. So ja in German means yes, and in Polish it means I. Nun in German means now, N-U-N in English means a female religious, a member of a female religious order. Things like that. So you can have individual signs, words, that have different meanings in different languages that seem to belong to more than one language. And you can say, well, you know, the way we normally individuate words is, of course, to say that they are specific to languages. So philosophers often distinguish between the individuation of signs and the individuation of words. So we can say there's one sign, N-U-N, right? But there are two different words, one in English and one in German, one in Greek as well, as it happens, and probably other languages too. So, you know, each language which uses that sign, N-U-N, has a different word. So the word is individuated by language, if you like. But there's a level of individuation, what we're calling the level of the sign. That's just a label, but it's trying to get, I think, at something real, at which it makes sense and is true to say that the sign N-U-N is the same sign in English and in German. It means one thing in English, it means another thing in German. And it's at that level that meaning attaches contingently to signs. And it's at that level that the theory of meaning is operating when it takes input sentences. So in other words, it's taking input signs, and then it's saying that these signs mean such and such in some language. And they might mean something different in some other language, and you'd have a different theory of meaning then for that other language. So the lexicon in the English theory of meaning will have an entry for the word N-U-N, and so will the lexicon in the German theory of meaning. But the entries will be quite different, as I said. Okay, and it's at that level, the level of the sign, that we want to say that the meaning of a sign is a contingent matter. It could have been otherwise. So that a clause like to, which tells you that the sentence in quote marks snow is white means that snow is white, so that kind of clause from a homophonic theory of meaning, is not in fact telling you something trivial or useless. It's conveying a substantial piece of information, because that collocation of signs has its meaning contingently, could have meant something different, but this is what it does mean in English. And as I say, it states a learnable and forgettable fact. So not a triviality. And the value of looking at the heterophonic case is that it's easier to see that point in the heterophonic case. That's why I've been mentioning that. It's easier to see that if you don't know German and I tell you that the sentence Schnee ist weiß means snow is white, I've told you something that you didn't know and you've learned something. And it's easy to see that a substantial piece of information has been conveyed. It's perhaps slightly more difficult to see that the same is going on in the homophonic case, but in fact, exactly the same process is going on. A contingent connection is being drawn between a bunch of signs and a meaning. And the appearance of triviality comes from the fact that we mentioned before, which is that you couldn't use, whereas you could use clauses like three to at least start to teach somebody German, you couldn't use a clause like two to teach anyone English, because you've already got to know English in order to understand the theory. So you'd never be able to get going. But as I said before, the whole point of a theory of meaning is not to teach anyone. It's not language instruction. So the fact that two would be useless for that purpose is neither here nor there. The purpose for which we require a theory of meaning and clauses like two is to model understanding. So we require it for a philosophical rather than a pedagogic purpose. We require it as something which will help us understand what is going on when speakers understand a language. Now, another angle on the triviality point, I think, is comparing a clause like to, so snow is white in inverted commas, means that snow is white, with a clause like five in the lecture notes, where you have the same sentence on both left-hand side and right-hand side, but instead of being mentioned on the left-hand side and used on the right-hand side, as in the case of two, in the case of five, as you see, it is mentioned on both sides. So five reads, snow is white, in inverted commas, means the same as snow is white, in inverted commas. Or, putting it another way, the sentence snow is white means the same as the sentence snow is white. And each time I say that sentence, I'm naming it, so I'm putting it in inverted commas. And five, compared to two, is relatively trivial. Somebody could know that without knowing English. In other words, I mean, if there's some language that, let's say, you don't know, let's say you don't know Spanish, I show you a sentence in Spanish and I say, does that sentence mean the same as that sentence? And I point to it twice, right? Or I point to it over here, and then I point to another inscription of the very same sentence over there. And I say, well, do those two things mean the same? And you have a look at both of them, you compare them, and you see that, yeah, it's the same sentence written twice. So that you can then answer, yes, that sentence means the same. This sentence over here means the same as that sentence over there. I don't know what they mean, I don't know what the sentence means, but I do know that we're talking about sameness of meaning here, because it's the same sentence. So we can all do that, even if we don't know the language. So it's a relatively trivial piece of information that is recorded in five. It's not quite completely trivial, because in order to know that five is true, you do at least have to know that snow is white, inverted commas, is a sentence of some language. Right, you do have to know that much. If it were just a series of meaningless marks placed in inverted commas, then the sentence that the clause that you would get from saying that those meaningless marks in inverted commas means the same as, and then you repeat the same meaningless marks again in inverted commas, that whole sentence wouldn't be true, because the meaningless marks in inverted commas are meaningless. They don't have any meaning at all, so they don't mean the same as anything. Okay, so five isn't utterly trivial, but it is relatively trivial. Trivial compared to two. Okay, now let's go back to the comparison between a systematic theory of meaning and a translation manual and say a little bit more about that. The essential difference, remember, is that the systematic theory of meaning deals in structure. It discerns structure in the input sentences to it. It breaks those down into their component parts and then computes the meaning of the whole sentence on the basis of the meanings of the parts and the grammar of the language. Whereas a translation manual, as that phrase is being used in this sort of context, simply gives a whole meaning for a whole sentence, without trying to break the sentence down into its parts, without trying to tell you what the bits mean individually. It simply tells you that this here sentence in Czech means the same as this here sentence in English. And that's all you know, as it were. You don't know how they come to mean the same, or whether there are, you know, what the individual connections between them, between their words are. So the systematic theory of meaning discerns structure, and that's its whole point. That's why it can model linguistic understanding. It can model creative language use, because that operates on structure, that exploits structure. And we can give a nice example of this. This is, I think, taken from Evans. You can see how this works out in a sort of toy case. If you imagine a very simple language, which has just got two names and two predicates. So the names are John and Jane, and the predicates are is happy and is hungry. And so if you look at the sentences 7 and 8 in the lecture notes, so the 7 is the sentence John is happy, and 8 is the sentence Jane is hungry. And then what we find, and this takes us back to the point about, this is an empirical point about creative language use, what we find when we train people in a language, and in particular what we find with children learning a language. You know, I mentioned previously that there's a kind of takeoff point where children suddenly start coming out with and understanding a whole lot of sentences that they haven't encountered before, and it's extraordinary. And so a little, this is an unrealistic model, of course, but just imagine you have a young child who's learning English and has been trained in the two sentences 7 and 8, John is happy and Jane is hungry. So the child is able to manipulate and use those sentences, you know, you might say not with full understanding, but with reasonable understanding. They're getting the hang. And what you find is, and this, as I say, is an empirical point coming in, what you find is that at a certain point, the child is able, without any further training, to understand the sentences 9 and 10, where the predicates are permuted. So, Jane is happy, John is hungry. So you've trained the child in the sentences John is happy and Jane is hungry, and you find that without further ado, without any further training, at a certain point, the child understands the sentence Jane is happy and John is hungry, so understands all four sentences, all four possible sentences with those two names and two predicates, even though the training has only focused on two of them. So this is a kind of toy model of what the systematic theory of meaning is aiming to explain. It's aiming to explain exactly that fact. You see, if the child had a if we had to model the child's understanding in terms of translation manual, in other words, meanings for whole sentences without breaking them down into their component parts, then it would be a complete mystery how the child who had been drilled in sentences 7 and 8 could then go on to understand 9 and 10. But the obvious way of explaining that, of modelling it, is to say, well, the child is obviously breaking these sentences down into their into parts, into names and predicates, and then it's able to juggle those parts and put them together in a different way. So it's able to put the names together with predicates that it hasn't heard being used with those particular names. But it's worked out that that's how the grammar of the language works. You put a name together with a predicate in English like this, predicate after the name in a simple sentence, and you arrive at a sentence which makes sense. So the child has got to the stage of learning in learning the grammar and vocabulary of English to be able to work out that if the sentences John is happy and Jane is hungry are good English sentences, then the sentences Jane is happy and John is hungry are also going to be good English sentences. And so the way the systematic theory of meaning would work in this toy case is by saying, well, the child has internalized an axiom for the name John, in other words, an axiom, a clause specifying what that name means, another one for the name Jane, another one for the predicate is happy, and another one for the predicate is hungry. And those are four separate entities. You've trained the child in two sentences, but the child has broken those sentences down into four bits and has learnt four separate clauses, giving the meanings of those four bits. So in other words, isn't treating the sentences as monolithic units, units that can't be divided up, as a translation manual would do, and giving meanings for whole sentences. Rather, the child is breaking the sentence down and giving meanings to the bits, and then operating with a single compositional rule. This is, in effect, the grammar of the toy language, because there'll be a single compositional rule saying, I've given it in the lecture notes under C, a sentence containing a name with a predicate means that the object referred to by the name satisfies the property referred to by the predicate. Well, that's a rather technical way of putting it, but all it's doing is saying, well, the child or the language learner has got a general understanding of what it is, what it means to put a name together with a predicate, how you work out the meaning of the whole sentence for any name and any predicate. So in other words, instead of learning the meanings of sentences 7 and 8, John is happy, Jane is hungry, as monolithic, unstructured units, the child has broken them down and has mastered clauses for each of the parts, the four parts, the two names and the two predicates, plus a compositional clause, And those five components enables the child to derive meanings for sentences nine and ten, where the names and the predicates are permuted to the new sentences, in other words. Now, the reason why this example is chosen is to illustrate the point is that if you take a very simple case like this and compare it with the translation manual and ask, well, which is more efficient? If you're only dealing with these two names and two predicates, then there's a sense in which the translation manual will be more efficient, because the translation manual, to give the meanings of those four sentences, 7, 8, 9, and 10, would only need four clauses, right? So your Berlitz guide, as it were, to this language would just contain four clauses, one for each of those sentences, whereas the systematic theory of meaning contains five clauses, as we've said. It contains two clauses for the names, two clauses for the predicates, and a compositional clause. So there's a sense there in which the translation manual seems to be more efficient than the systematic theory of meaning. But of course, that's just an artifact of the simplicity of the example. As soon as you make it slightly more complex, slightly more realistic, very quickly indeed, the systematic theory of meaning becomes more efficient. So to take an example, suppose you have 10 names and 10 predicates, which you've taught your child. The child is then able to understand 100 sentences. A translation manual would have 100 clauses, one for each sentence. So it would be relatively inefficient. Whereas a systematic theory of meaning would have how many? How many basic clauses? It would have 21. 10 for the names, 10 for the predicates, and then just again one single compositional clause, which would do for everything. That's where the efficiency comes in the grammar rather than in the lexicon. A lexicon is quite a large, unwieldy entity, as you'll know if you've ever tried to carry around the old hard copy of the Oxford English Dictionary. And you can't economize on the lexicon. A speaker has to learn at least a substantial proportion of the lexicon, has to acquire a reasonably large vocabulary, and there aren't really any shortcuts. You have to learn that case by case, word by word. Sometimes, you know, complex words, more sophisticated words, you can work out their meanings, but in many cases you have to learn each word individually. But then the economy, as I say, comes with the grammar, because the general clause is telling you how to put words together to form good sentences of the language. You only need to give one clause for each construction, right? And then that construction can be replicated many times. So once you've learned the rule of conjunction, for instance, how to use the word and, you've learnt a method for generating and understanding countless new sentences. Many of those sentences will be too long and complicated to be of much use, but in principle, they will have a meaning, and you can, in principle, understand that meaning. So here we have the point again that the systematic theory of meaning is able to model in a finite way the infinitistic capacity of speakers. So the grammar and the lexicon that are built into the theory will be finite, but they will generate an infinitude of sentences. So they will model the unboundedness of speakers' understanding of language. Now, let me just finish with a point in connection with that from Gareth Evans's paper, Semantic Theory and Tacit Knowledge, and I've taken some of my materials from that paper. Evans suggests in that article that the project of constructing a systematic theory of meaning, or rather of thinking about what would be involved in doing so, because philosophers are working at a fairly high level of abstraction, and mostly they're not attempting to actually construct such theories, they're just thinking about what would be involved in doing so and what we can learn from that. Evans's idea is that that project is continuous with, well, basically a study of the brain, a neurophysiological study of the brain. So that the theory that we imagine ourselves writing for a language will at least start to tell us about causal structures in the brain underlying linguistic competence. Now, I think this is a thought that one has to be rather careful with, because I think there's a risk of conflating two different projects. I mean, the idea of a systematic theory of meaning is the idea of something that models speakers' linguistic capacities. And it models them at a fairly high level of abstraction. That's to say, it isn't really committed to there being particular causal structures in the brain which correspond in any kind of detail to the machinery of the theory. So remember, the machinery of the theory basically consists of a lexicon and a grammar, as we've said, a dictionary and a grammar. And the dictionary consists of clauses giving meanings of individual words, and the grammar consists of a bunch of constructions and how they work. Now, it would be absurd, I think, to suppose that that is going to transfer in any neat way to the empirical project of understanding how linguistic structures are causally embedded in the brain. It's not as though you would expect to be able to look at the brain and find little bits corresponding to, or little structures in the brain corresponding precisely to the clauses of of the machinery of your theory. I mean, we already know enough about language in the brain to know that the position is much more holistic than that in the brain. That's to say, different areas of the brain are relevant, they affect each other, and the capacity is, as it were, spread over areas of the brain rather than being neatly compartmentalized. And it's not the point of a systematic theory of meaning to sort of do armchair science, to, as it were, guide the neurophysiologist, as it were, saying to the neurophysiologist, look, you should expect to find a component in the brain or a function in the brain which corresponds to these particular clauses that I'm writing in my theory of meaning. No, that, as I say, is to confuse two quite different projects. The point of the theory of meaning is not to, as it were, to start out on doing an empirical study of the brain, of the way language is wired in the brain. Rather, as I say, it's to bring philosophical illumination in the sense of modelling in a perspicuous way, that's to say, using a deductive apparatus, an ability that speakers plainly have. So you start with an empirical fact, to be sure, that speakers use language creatively, yet they're finite beings, and the systematic theory of meaning is then a way of trying to understand how these two things are possible together, how finite beings can have infinitistic capacities. Now, you might say, well, I mean, we've been talking about high levels of abstraction. At a certain level, the systematic theory is going to describe what's going on in the brain. Because after all, if the theory is correct, that's to say, if it accurately captures a speaker's understanding, and that understanding is in some way wired in the brain, then the theory is ipso facto describing the functioning of the brain in a certain way, at a certain level of description. Right. But it's a very abstract level, that's the point. There need be no precise connections between the clauses of the theory of meaning and anything that a neurophysiologist would recognize as a component or an activity of a component of the brain. That the fit can be a very general one. In some sense, the brain is a linguistic machine, and if the theory correctly describes the speaker's capacities, then there's a sense in which the theory is realized in the brain. The brain is driving, is operating in a way that that theory describes. But as I say, the fit between theory and brain activity need be no more than very general indeed. Okay, we'll leave the matter there, and next time we will look at Davidson's approach to theories of meaning, the ideas of radical interpretation, and his project of basing a theory of meaning on what's called a theory of truth. So we will have a look at those two ideas next time round.